I've prepared a talk tonight, and I may get to it for tonight. I may get to it, but I'd actually like to, if you'll bear with me, I'd like to talk about a Dharma that feels more immediate to me right now. Very fresh. I had the privilege this afternoon of spending some time with someone who's probably within days of dying, and with his family. It was a really interesting experience. He's 21 years old. It's been a year and a half of a very aggressive cancer. He shared with me there have been 11 rounds of chemotherapy and radiation. And we had such an interesting conversation. We talked about what kind of memorial service he would like to have and his family would like to have, and he told me that up until he was probably about 18, he wanted to have strippers at his memorial service. But he's let that idea go. And we talked a lot about love and how it heals and the difference between grief and love and the fact that love doesn't know anything about separation and death. That to love, death is only an illusion. We talked about quite a number of things, and I found it actually quite remarkable for this very young person to be in such an absolutely clear, open, matter-of-fact, simple place. I couldn't see a trace of fear as he approaches death. I saw a very profound level of equanimity. He seems to be absolutely settled with what's happening. A bunch of friends are flying in from all over the country. His friends are flying in from all over the country this weekend. He'd like to be here to see them. And they're all going to turn that home into a kind of hippie crash pad for a weekend. There's been a lot of physical pain. There still is a great deal of physical pain. What I found so remarkable was essentially all our practice is about, all the teaching is about, all the practice is about, is whether we're creating suffering for ourselves or whether we're creating happiness for ourselves. And I could see very little trace of creating any kind of suffering. And this is not a Buddhist, not a meditator, but somebody who has used this very challenging journey at such a very young age to come to what seemed to me, I told him, you're in a great place. To come to such a beautiful place psychically and spiritually, even as the body goes, and his family. Just a real beautiful environment of love. One thing that I especially honored is I just mentioned to him that I am exactly three times his age at 63. And I said, I would happily trade places with him if I could, because I've really gotten everything that I've wanted for my life. In fact, much more than I could ever have dreamed of. And that it would be wonderful to give him some time at such a young age. He said, there's 42 years between us. I'd love to give you those years. And he said, I wouldn't take it. There was that level of equanimity, actually. He said, what has come to me is what has come to me, and that's just fine. Isn't that remarkable? That level of wisdom. So, we throw around all these ideas. We have this practice. We have an enormous body of teaching in this tradition. But it all comes down to whether there is a sense of peace in the heart whether there is a lack of fear in the heart. It doesn't mean that he hasn't felt agitation and anger. I said, how come no anger? And he said, well, I got rid of that a long time ago. You know, that's essentially where we want to be. So I'd be happy to go now to the talk, and I'm just wondering if you could take a sheet and pass. Going to be talking about a particularly gnarly subject this evening, but just to remember that as complicated and gnarly as sometimes the teaching can get, it's not about ideas. It's about actually training ourselves to get to a place where we're not creating suffering for ourselves. And this may be helpful to you or it may not. Does everyone get a copy? I am grateful to the Vipassana teacher, Steve Armstrong, for this drawing. I don't draw well, and this, I probably got this from Steve Armstrong, I don't know, 26 years ago. And so let me just try to put this in context. In my youth, when I was young, I was really, my whole life was propelled by essentially two questions. Why is there suffering, and what can I do about it? And I grew up in a family where there was a whole lot of suffering. And there's been a great deal of suffering in my life. And so when other kids were out enjoying themselves, I was poring through George Friedrich Nietzsche trying to find the answer to my questions, and a lot of others. And just digging into every tradition I could find, trying to get an answer. Why is there suffering? And what can I do about it? And it was really wonderful. I think I must have been 21 years old, same age as this young man who's dying. I think when I was 21, I finally found somebody who was actually also obsessed with that question. And obsessed with it way back in really the dawn of recorded history. In actually a pre-literate culture. So there was this very fortunate young person who was kind of an ancient Richie Rich, if you remember Richie Rich, who had everything, and essentially lived a life of pleasure and denial. Was given every conceivable pleasure, and was essentially infantilized. So believe it or not, this young person got to the age of 29 without really knowing that death existed. Was that protected? And then all of a sudden, at the age of 29, reality came flooding in. We don't need to go into the particular circumstances, but he came to discover that he was going to grow old and get sick and die. And it was a terrible shock. And then all of a sudden, he was compelled by the same two questions. Why is there suffering, and what can I do about it? So he was being trained to take over the kingdom from his father. And when he became obsessed with these questions, his father said, "Can't you forget about that? You know, you've got to be trained here to take over." And this young prince said, "Why should I, who am subject to decay and death, pursue that which is also subject to decay and death?" So he was pretty focused. And he left. He ran away, as it were, leaving the kingdom behind, leaving all the palaces behind, leaving a new wife and a young child behind, a baby child, and spent 6 years of deep pursuit trying to get the answer to that question, to those questions, essentially. Looking this way, looking that way, training with all the best spiritual teachers of that time, and nobody had the answer for him. And then, you know, lucky for us, around 528, the year 528 BCE, he sat down under a tree and he made a very firm resolve. He was really determined. If I may, I'll share with you his resolve. When he sat down under the tree, he had some idea that he was going to get his answers. He had a premonition that an answer was coming. And so when he sat down, he said, "I will not stand up until I know the answer to these questions. You know, if I die here, so be it." So a very strong determination. And here's the way he put it when he sat down. He said, "If the end is attainable by human effort, I will not rest or relax until it is attained. That is, discovering the truth, especially about these two questions. Let only my skin and sinews and bones remain. Let my flesh and blood dry up. I will not stop the course of my effort until I win that which may be won by human ability, human effort, human exertion." So lucky for him, he didn't have to have all those awful things happen, only his skin and sinews and bones remaining. He discovered the truth. And what he discovered in the course of the night, sitting under the tree, the first thing that happened to him is he actually had a vision where he was able to see what he claimed to be all of his past lifetimes in detail. And what he discovered is that there was no beginning. There was never a beginning to the round of birth and death, to the round of suffering. So here's the way he put it. I should have marked the page. He said, "Inconceivable is the beginning of this samsara, that is the cycle of birth and death. Not to be discovered is a first beginning of beings who, obstructed by ignorance and ensnared by craving, are hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirths." And what follows is not a metaphor, he means it literally. "Which do you think, O monks, is more? The flood of tears which, weeping and wailing, you have shed upon this long way, hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirths, united with the undesired, separated from the desired, this or all the waters of the four great oceans? Long have you suffered the death of father and mother, of sons, daughters, brothers, and sisters, and whilst you were suffering, you have indeed shed more tears upon this long way than there is water in the four great oceans. I remember standing on the edge of the Pacific and looking out and thinking, whoa, baby. And thus, O monks, have you undergone suffering, undergone torment, undergone misfortune, and filled the graveyards full? Verily, long enough to be dissatisfied with all the forms of existence, long enough to turn away and free yourselves from them all. So he talks about one world period. Who knows? Maybe it's the amount of time it takes for the Big Bang to happen and for the universe to reach its limit and then the contraction. Who knows? But he says, he talks about one world period, that is, they're called kalpa in Sanskrit, kappa. Long, O monks, lasts one world period, and not possible is it to count it as so many years, so many centuries, so many millenniums, so many hundred millenniums. Suppose there be a mighty rock, 1 mile deep, 1 mile wide, 1 mile high, without breaches or crevices, of one solid mass. And whenever 100 years have elapsed, a man should come and rub only once with a little silken cloth against this rock. Then this mighty rock would vanish quicker than one world period lasts. This is the duration of one world period, but through many such world periods, O monks, have you hurried and hastened through many hundreds, many thousands, many hundreds thousands of world periods. And how is this possible? Inconceivable, O monks, is the beginning of this samsara. Not to be discovered is a first beginning of beings who, obstructed by ignorance and ensnared by craving, are hurrying and hastening through this round of rebirths. So that's kind of amazing. If he was right, you know, again, you don't have to believe any of this stuff. But if you would, if you could just do a little suspension of disbelief and just entertain the idea that you and I and all of us have lived an infinite number of lives with no beginning and no end, unless we can essentially answer these two questions. Why is there suffering and what can I do about it? So the Buddha said you can break the cycle. And what he discovered, so he discovered first in that night when he was sitting under the tree after that very firm resolve, he was able to see, he claimed, all of his previous lives. And then he was able to see actually the whole unfolding of lives for all of us. He claimed that he had that vision. He came to understand the law of cause and effect, that this happens because that happens. The law of causation, which is really wonderful, because if this doesn't happen, this won't happen. You know, which is where which is actually how we free ourselves. And then at the end of the night, he said that he saw the morning star, and his mind opened, and he was free. He was free from that cycle. And what he said when his mind opened, uses a metaphor of a builder. This is the builder of this body, the builder of this life. Vainly I sought the builder of my house through countless lives. I could not find the builder. How hard it is to tread life after life. But now I see you, O builder, and never again shall you build my house. I have snapped the rafters, split the ridgepole, and beaten out desire. And now my mind is free. Done is what had to be done. All sorrow has ceased. So I am looking forward to the time when you and I and every living being can say, and now my mind is free. Done is what had to be done. All sorrow has ceased. So what the Buddha was able to discover by coming to understand the law of cause and effect, essentially what he did is he traced it back. He was able with his mind, and I think it's just an extraordinary thing that he was able to do this. He said, okay, there's suffering here. You know, what comes before that? And he was actually able to see a chain of causation. One thing causing another, causing another, causing another, in a cycle. And he realized that because of the law of cause and effect, if any one of those links in the chain were removed, the whole chain would disappear. And basically what he came to understand is he saw why there is suffering, and he saw what we can do about it. So when he saw the nature of suffering, and he saw its cause basically in craving and grasping, of resisting what we don't want and trying to hold on to what we do want. And he came to see that if you remove the cause, the suffering will cease. And so he came to see that actually if we stop craving and grasping, if we stop resisting and clinging, then suffering won't exist anymore. And then he saw that there's actually a way to come to that cessation, to that ending of suffering. Just to go back to this young man that I met with today, he's gone through some very, very unpleasant stuff, including this morning. The morphine drip somehow failed, and he was in agony of pain. And when I arrived, his parents said, you know, he probably can't talk to you. He had a horrible morning. He's asleep now. Maybe you can talk to us. And then we had lunch, and we went in, and there he was awake and very willing to talk and very clear and cogent. So there's been a lot of unpleasant. I didn't see any resistance to it. And I looked. And if he were clinging to life, if he were clinging to pleasure, if he were clinging to any kind of aspiration, there would be suffering. He wasn't resisting, he wasn't clinging. Seemed to be in a very, very peaceful place. So I'm bringing this around to a specific example because all of this can sound very abstract. But you know what? We're all going to be in that place where we're just right on the cusp of dying. We may not do it at 21. So what the Buddha was able to see is that there is this wonderful chain of causation. So the law of dependent origination, you just say those words and people's eyes glaze over. Oh, no. Is he going to give us another talk about the law of dependent origination? So let's, it is a difficult and gnarly subject, but let's make it, is there some way that we can make this real? Because here's the answer. You know, here's the answer to the question that so obsessed me when I was young. Here's the answer to why there's suffering. And actually, when we come to understand it, we realize what we can do about it. So, if you don't mind, and Christina, I'm so sorry that we can't. You're not able to see this, so let me try to describe it. The Buddha said, if you look at link number one, ignorance. Essentially, he said this is not the first cause. Yeah, it's so interesting. I'm going to step back for a minute, just for a moment, and You know, in the Western understanding of the cosmos, in, say, the Judeo-Christian understanding of the cosmos, it's also kind of small and tidy. You know, there's a beginning. In the beginning, you know, God created the heaven and the earth. There was somebody created something. And so there was a beginning. That's a whole lot easier to get your mind around than somebody telling you there was no ever a beginning. So there's a beginning. And then there's a middle, which is the middle of struggle and transformation in the Judeo-Christian. And then there's an end. You know, there's Genesis and then there's the apocalypse at the end. You know, where the Creator basically pulls the plug on creation. And creation ends. There's a beginning, there's a middle, there's an end in the apocalypse. In the book of the Apocalypse, it's very beautiful language. Time is, time was, but time shall be no more. It's also wonderfully tidy. And that's what we do with a novel. You know, that's what Snoopy does every time he writes a novel. You know, it was a dark and stormy night. You know, he has a beginning. Presumably, there's a middle and there's an end. And the Buddha basically is saying something very different. He's saying, there is no beginning, there is no end to this. So there's no prime cause, but the proximate cause, the major cause of our suffering, is ignorance. It's not understanding what is true. And specifically what that means, what ignorance means, it's not understanding that there is suffering and its causes and its end and a way to the end. It's not understanding, it's seeing experience as permanent, desirable, attractive, and self, rather than seeing them as impermanent, unsatisfactory because they're unreliable, because they're impermanent, and not self. So, ignorance. Because ignorance exists, all the rest of these of this chain happens. And there are basically two places where we can intervene in this chain of causation. And the first is to remove ignorance. The Buddha said, if you remove ignorance, if we come to understand reality as it actually is, then this whole chain falls apart and you can forget about suffering anymore. You can forget about the endless round. So that's what we're trying to do in our practice. We're trying to uproot the whole process by removing ignorance. But short of that, there's another place where we can intervene. Most of this is not volitional. It doesn't. We don't have control over it. But we can actually train ourselves to understand what is true and what is not true. As we come to understand what is true deeper and deeper and deeper, then this whole chain falls apart. But if we haven't eliminated ignorance, according to the Buddha, and again, you don't have to believe this stuff about multiple lives, but just at least keep an open mind about it. Because of ignorance, it causes karmic formations. And essentially, this is the second chain. And essentially, those are volitional actions. If those of you who know the Noble Eightfold Path, it's out of our understanding that our intentions come, and out of our intentions, our speech and our action and our livelihood come. And so, if you have misunderstanding, you know, then you're going to have different kinds of. If you don't have clear understanding, you're going to have different kinds of intentions and actions. And speech and livelihood. So we essentially start accumulating karma. So the volition, or our intentions, are the seeds. And then what happens from that is the third, which is consciousness arises. So out of ignorance we have intentions. Out of intentions comes birth consciousness, rebirth consciousness. So consciousness forms. It's the sprouting of the seed. So we take birth again into the realms of suffering. Life begins at conception with a moment of consciousness, and that stream of consciousness continues unbroken until we die. And then there is another moment of birth consciousness, and on it goes. So there's consciousness, there's this moment of birth consciousness, and then a mind and body form. The coming together of matter and mind, the mind-body process, the psychophysical organism. It begins with a one-cell fertilized egg, and then it develops. So the first is ignorance, the second is volition, the third is consciousness of birth consciousness, the fourth is out of that consciousness we come up with a mind and a body, and then the fifth is we develop senses. With the body, we get senses, six senses. So the embryo grows them, these senses. And for us, there are six. There are the usual five plus mind. Our seeing, the capacity to see, to hear, to smell, to taste, to touch, and to think and feel, essentially. And out of the six senses, once we have senses, then there's contact with the world. So there may be a sight, and there's awareness of sight. There's a sound, so there's awareness of sound, a smell, a taste, a physical sensation, a thought, an emotion, and we can know them. So there's contact with the world. And then, so that's the sixth step. The seventh step is the fact that everything that happens to us is going to be pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. An unpleasant sound, an unpleasant smell. You know, think of the most unpleasant smell you have ever encountered, and what did you feel in response to it? You know, exactly. Ooh. So there's, because we've got a mind and a body, and because we've developed senses, then we have contact with the world. Things happen to us through our eye, our ear, our nose, our tongue, our body, and our mind. It's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. And here is the place where we can break the chain. If essentially the next step is craving, that is, if the experience is pleasant, we have desire for it and we grasp for it. If it's unpleasant, we don't like it, we resist it, we try to get rid of it. That's where we have a choice. We'll come back to that. So there's craving, and then the craving actually becomes a grasping. We latch onto objects of the six senses. And out of that grasping come more karmic formations, which is the tenth step, and essentially that's identical to, I think, the second step. And out of the karmic formations, we take birth again, and then out of birth comes disease, sorrow, decay, suffering, grief, despair, and death. So we've gone back basically from a past life through this life to a future life, and it goes on and on and on. And the wonderful thing about our practice, and the reason that we talk about this so much, is right there in the place where we can intervene. Is that it's right there between 7 and 8. So we have contact, it's pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, and if we don't crave and cling, if we don't grasp, if we don't resist, then we've broken the chain. And that's what our training is. We're training ourselves to know what's happening, and then we're training ourselves to notice how we're relating to what's happening, and we start to change our relationship. And as you do more and more of this, it doesn't sound so abstract, you realize, oh, you know, that person who used to drive me absolutely nuts because they're so obnoxious, I can just look at them and hear them and not react anymore. You know, we change our response to things. Oh, that thing to which I was addicted, you know, the addiction to the food or to the alcohol or to the drugs or to the sex or whatever that we're addicted to, or the television, that thing to which we were addicted, you come to see, oh, it's just craving for what is pleasant. And I don't have to grasp and cling anymore, and we actually can break the addiction. So this is not, you see, this is not theoretical. So that's essentially what this dependent origination, these 12 steps of dependent origination, is actually a very subtle explanation of the second noble truth, for those of you who know it, the cause of suffering. You come to understand the cause, you see exactly how it's created, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime, this cycle of causation, and you can break that cycle either by coming to understand what is true or deciding not to react anymore to your experience. So the Buddha says, it is through not understanding this deep truth of causation, that all living beings, this generation of beings, has become entangled like a matted ball of thread, become like grass and rushes, unable to pass beyond the woeful states of existence, of samsara, the cycle of existence. So how do we free ourselves? You know, if we want to sum it up into just one thing, you know, just one thing, the Buddha said, if you want to be free, if you want to get out of this cycle, this endless cycle, again and again and again, of doing this to ourselves, because nobody's doing it to us. The Buddha said, nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. Nothing whatsoever is to be clung to as I or mine. Whoever has heard this truth has heard all of the teaching. Whoever practices this truth has practiced all of the teaching. Whoever realizes this truth has realized all of the teaching. So if this young man that I met today, you know, to come up with his memorial service, if he believes that he is this body, he's going to be suffering terribly right now because he's about to lose it. He doesn't seem to be suffering. He doesn't seem to be identified with this body. It's that simple. He doesn't cling to it as I or mine. And so the mind is quite free. Understand, there must have been a terrible struggle to get there. But I just find it amazing. I've been with a lot of dying people in my life, and it's rare to see people who, you know, have basically worked it through. And I said to his parents afterward, he's in great shape. You know, whoa. You know, so lucky to have a mind that's basically just there, very present, being with it, allowing it to happen, and surrounded by loving people. May we all die in those circumstances. You know, I said to him, you know, I'll hold you in my heart, and I'm going to really wish for you that you have a really good landing somewhere. But I said, I'm really confident that you're going to have a good landing somewhere because all the conditions are here, are right here. So, gnarly subject. I hope it can be useful to you. And I hope, you know, that it doesn't stay on the level of an intellectual sort of teaser, but really that you can take this and actually apply it to your life. Find out what's true. You know, not what I tell you is true, not what the Buddha tells you is true, but actually find out what is really true that you know for yourself in your own heart with absolute conviction. Find out what is true, and then all of this stuff falls away. Or if you haven't, you know, utterly found out what is true, pay close attention to your experience and how you're relating to it or responding to it or reacting to it. And notice, you know, it's not the cancer that's causing your suffering. It's the way that you respond to the cancer. You can be happy with terminal cancer, or you can be miserable with terminal cancer, or whatever else. You know, the awful abuser is causing your suffering. It's really good to get out of that situation that the abuser is not causing your suffering. We don't ever have to be victims. No matter what's being done to us, we can be tortured, but we don't have to be victims. It's really how we're responding to our situation. I think in my last talk, I mentioned the nun who had been captured by the Chinese and tortured for years, and she came out, and her heart was, she didn't have post-traumatic stress disorder, she wasn't troubled, and people said, how could you possibly do that? And she said, I had this mantra that I said over and over and over and over again, thank you for everything, I have no complaints whatsoever. That's an amazing practice, and that's an amazing accomplishment, but that can be done. Do you see? That is a non-reactive mind. Or when her mind went into reaction, she basically said those words to herself again and again. I have no thank you for everything. Not thank you for the nice things. Thank you for everything. I have no complaints whatsoever. So may we all put an end to ignorance. And by putting an end to ignorance, putting an end to all unhappiness. May this be true for us all. Thank you.